On the Other Side on Mind Talk, I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do.
I am very pleased to introduce to you today's guest. She is Sheila Ford Murphy, and she has over 20 years of for-profit and nonprofit experience. Her wealth of planning, fundraising, organizing, and leadership development experience has positioned her with dynamic expertise and networks. She is an international traveler. She is very involved in things domestically as well as I said, internationally. So let's say hello to today's guest, Sheila Ford Murphy. Hello, Sheila. Hey, how are you?
Hey, good morning, Dr. Brewer. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Now, Sheila, there's another hat that you wear these days, and it is as the CEO of Mission to Mobilization. So there's a lot that you're doing. But I'd like to start with Sheila Ford, the little one. What was going on in your life? Where were you born? Who was in your household? Your early influences. Let's start there.
Sure. I'm actually a native Minnesotan, and so I grew up in a two-parent blue-collar family, and there was just two siblings, my younger brother and I, so I have the older child syndrome. And but my I pursued my undergrad in Alabama, at Alabama State in Montgomery, Alabama, and then I came back and started my corporate career and finished up a master's in biblical studies and administration. And so my corporate career really started, you know, in a couple of Fortune 500 companies. And I, you know, at the same time, I really had an unsettling for me. I think because of even really my mother was the type of person that was always concerned about someone else. I mean, some of even my mm-hmm. early lessons in life were, you know, someone came by our door and they needed something to eat. And she had them, you know, wait outside, and she went to the kitchen and fixed them a plate of stew. Went back and then gave it to them, and then, you know, he finished or whatever, and then he walked away, and so we were kind of watching him walk away, and then all of a sudden we kind of couldn't see where he went. But my mother just kind of just a life lesson of, you know, you never, you know, turn down someone that is in need if it's within your ability to do that. And I just remember that, and they're so just recalling different things like that. As I started my corporate career, I had in the back of my mind, I'm still not comfortable with what's happening in my community. So mm-hmm. really in tandem, I was always working and volunteering. I was, you know, working in a corporate job uh-huh. and then serving in some capacity, most likely, you know, in my church.
Okay.
And so, you know, and then I was ended up, as I was serving, then there became another unrest for me with corrections. And so it seems, undergirded all of that was my faith. So I grew up in the church. You know, I, you know, baptized early, at the age of 9. I really, you know, felt like I was feeling a pull, as they would say, you know, okay. spiritually mm-hmm. To increase my faith. And that, I think, with another layer or a layer and foundation for the different venues that I found myself in and serving and working, to change what I was seeing in the community.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Your mom clearly mm-hmm. was a powerful influence in your life, and she taught you to give what you could when you could. You are an African-American woman. What are some of the things that she taught you, if anything, specifically about being a woman and a woman of color in these United States? Anything?
Yes. Okay, so two major things. I think the one was that I always needed to be a step above. I needed to work harder, faster, stronger, because there was going to be a level of discrimination, you know, just off top, that was clear that was going to happen. So I needed to do my best because my counterpart, my white counterparts, you know, in the field that I was in, they could be equal, but they would not be considered. I would not be considered equal. So I had to prove myself no matter where I was. And my father as well used to say, I mean, it's just a simple thing, but he would say, okay, you know, if you're going to clean the street, if you're going to be a street cleaner, which is not what he wanted me to be, but he said, if you're going to be a street cleaner, be the best, let your streets be the cleanest streets in the city. You need to work hard and serve so that your works and your outcome, which they weren't using those terms, but that was going to shine. And so I think, and the second thing, my mother really believed that beauty was on the inside, you know, first, really, off, you know, more important than anything. She's like, you know, you can have somebody that looks really beautiful, but if they have an ugly spirit, ugly attitude, you know, they're hurtful and they are hurt, then that is what's going to come out. And that her desire for me really was to rear me in a way that I loved myself, and that if I loved myself, then I would be able to give love to other people freely.
Now, I mean, these are pretty heavy lessons for an adult to pay attention to, certainly for a little one growing up. You know, if you've got a parent telling you, you've got to work harder, work faster, be stronger, you know, you can do a couple of things with that. I mean, you can do a lot of things with that, but, you know, you can either say, that's it, forget it, I'm just not even going to bother. You can be energized by it. You can be angered by it. How did you hear those lessons from your family?
You know, obviously I'm articulating it, you know, now, because I can see that was what was happening at that time. There was some... I think that you just, when you are reared a certain way, you don't know anything else.
Yeah.
So I just knew, you know, that I was supposed to do my best, you know, and that, you know, C's were not good enough. And so my parents, we would look at my report card and say, okay, you could, maybe you're not that strong in math, but you can be stronger if you try harder. When we, you know, clean our rooms, I mean, something as simple as, I remember we would get allowance. And so you would receive allowance for the work that you did, you know, with the things that we were tasked to do. My dad, he said, okay, are you sure that your room is clean? I said, yes, it is. He goes in there and he pulls out these white gloves. And I'm like, well, where did these white gloves come from?
Oh, no.
And he goes over the top of the door post and he finds dust. And, you know, he was in the military. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, this is not right. I'm serious. First of all, I can't even get up there. Secondly, you didn't say that you were going to check up on top of the door. But the lesson that I have kept through life is that my role is to really think, you know, be a 360 thinker.
Okay.
You know, I need to look all the way around, you know, look at where I want to go, but also who and how could, what strategies do I need to use in terms of who I'm speaking to, who I'm working with, you know, my dad with what background he had, my mom with, you know, the influence she brought. And so at that time, I didn't realize that that's how they were shaping me,
you
know, in the way that they knew how. But I believe with God's help, that developed me into, you know, a very thoughtful yet grounded, you know, young woman and adult.
Something tells me that you took those early lessons with you into your corporate world as well as your non-corporate world. Talk to us a little bit about your early corporate experiences. Did you enjoy them? Were they fulfilling for you? What was going on then?
You know, being an African-American woman in a Fortune 500 company in Minnesota, just say that by itself.
Right.
that alone, it was challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew going in that I needed to work hard. And I believe that I, instead of becoming bitter with some of the challenges that I saw, you know, sometimes I would see that there were things that needed to be changed, and I would be the one to stand up for some of the different approaches that maybe we wanted to take as a team. I thought that that's where we were going to approach it, but then it ended up that I was the only one that was going to speak up. And so I would become frustrated and decided that I was not going to become bitter. How can I take this frustration and convert it to something that's going to help me and maybe even help those that, you know, may be around me? But I really wasn't kind of thinking about them at the time. But I did learn, one of the lessons I learned was, how can I be a better manager? I mean, I believe that I had some individuals that needed greater leadership skills. And I said, so instead of becoming bitter and angry, okay, so I can filter what they have done right.
Okay.
And then let go of what was wrong. And so then when I will be in a position to lead people, I want to remember these things. I'm writing these things down. I'm a big proponent for journaling, you know, remembering what am I taking away from this experience, whether even though it could be extremely negative.
Gotcha.
And so that, I think that was probably some of the greatest lessons that I learned in early in my corporate life.
Sheila, we're going to take a break in a moment, but when we come back, there are folks listening who may not have as much clarity as you would imagine about what it meant, what it means to be an African-American in a corporate environment in Minnesota. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want you to share a little bit of what that means to you as you talk about that.
Okay.
This is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk, and I am having a conversation with Sheila Ford Murphy, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Mission to Mobilization, and we'll find out more about that program when we return. Ford Murphy, what did it mean and what does it mean to be an African-American woman in the corporate world in Minnesota?
I think the biggest thing for me is maybe it's a simple way of thinking about it was they don't love you. There have been a number of African-American women and men that have had successful careers, you know, in Minnesota, you know, in Fortune 500 companies and more than that. But for me, my personal experience was there was no love for me in that environment.
Okay. Okay.
And, you know, my dad used to say, they have this saying that, you know, don't let your love be on a one-way street.
Mm.
And so, and so I would think about, it's just like, you know, trying to have a relationship with somebody that doesn't love you back. And so I really believe that, you know, kind of God's plan, that where I didn't feel that love and I had to be able to turn it somewhere. So that's why I go back to my community life was always in tandem with my corporate life, because I wasn't getting that love and I wasn't able to really allow the skills and intellect and love I had for people and work to be displayed in that environment. I turned to, you know, my community and to the work of corrections, because I believe that, and I was seeing visibly that work and love being manifested, you know, in a very positive way. And so so I chose to make some choices about, you know, what that looked like for me.
What was there anything about your corporate experiences that specifically led you to doing work in corrections, or was that a totally separate piece for you?
I really believe it was more just a kind of a culmination of just a lot of little things. I think the probably just a lot of little things. Just seeing, you know, same, having not just myself but other African Americans, you know, come up with great ideas, and then the ideas either are presented by someone else, maybe by a white counterpart, and then it's a bright, brilliant idea when it just came out of the mouth of either myself or someone else, that you, and so that became extremely frustrating. That may have been maybe the biggest push.
Okay.
But also my faith. I mean, I'm a praying person, and so in my prayer time, studying and thinking about and discerning and really seeking direction from God about what to do with my life, and what I was doing was hitting my head against this wall and then needing to make some decisions. So a combination of both the negative experiences in my corporate life and my faith, and really believing I'm hearing and seeing some more open doors in a different direction.
Well, let's talk about that different direction. What different direction did you take?
Right. So I started, you know, I was working through my church. I was, you know, visiting, really doing outreach, always different types of outreach. So I could started off really visiting nursing homes and youth centers. I've always had a love for youth and education. But I also sing. And so I started going actually to jails and prisons as a part of a group of people that were singing and reading scripture. And as I was just participating in that, I'm still praying and thinking, and I really felt like there's got to be more. So I started doing more research about what the community was doing to help those that were incarcerated, and then what was happening with the, you know, actually in corrections in itself. And, you know, and you could see that there, it was like this huge chasm, it was a gap between, I think, what many that were incarcerated needed in from the community, and then what the community was either willing or able to provide. And so they're really kind of the kind of crust of how at least my work with really changing the way we see returning citizens in this community. So, you know, Mission Mobilization started in 2003, and as you know mentioned, I've had this blend of, you know, with my corporate and corrections community and church, but those four allowed me to, you know, write material, to go into jails and prisons, and to use that the book Resource and Release as a tool to help men and women that are recently that are incarcerated become prepared to go out into the community. and then the experience, which is some other material, it's a simulation workshop, is material is actually geared towards and targeted to the community. So it's this bridging these two, where I see the chasm, trying to bridge those two areas.
You know, as you were talking a moment ago, and you use the term corrections, which is, I mean, certainly what we, you know, we talk about correctional facilities and all of that. But in fact, what you're saying is that there was not a great deal of actual corrections happening in terms of experiences, or at the very least, not providing folks with the additional information that would be useful to actually return to the community. In Minnesota, well, let me ask you this. Were you going to prisons in Minnesota exclusively, or were you visiting prisons sort of across the country?
No, just in Minnesota.
And what did you notice about the population, if you noticed anything, for the prisons in Minnesota?
I noticed that the population was eager to receive support for faith and faith-related activity, and that the facilities and the leadership administration was eager, pretty as well as receptive to having people of faith come and support. And there was at least, you know, say 20 years or so ago, there was a limited amount of support for soft skills and, you know, training programs, and those that's been across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not as if there wasn't anything in place. And just a point of clarity, I believe that there even today, there are, you know, life skills, training that is available for inmates. The issue is, I think a greater issue regarding returning citizens and the 4.5 million ex-offenders that are currently in our nation right now, is that we have a community that's not receptive to their return.
Hmm.
So while the church in some cases may have a prison ministry, and they will send someone in to do life skills or to provide religious services, which is good, the real issue is when inmates come out, there's an overwhelming belief that there are invisible bars in our community. So they come out, but there's myths, there's stereotypes, there is resistance to helping or supporting these men and women that have been recently released from incarceration. So that is what makes it very challenging. Thus, the work that Mission of Mobilization is called and poised to do right now, in terms of changing really the way our community receives and thinks about these men and women that have been recently released.
So the men and women who are incarcerated, actually, they can, I think what you're saying is, they can receive all the skills, training, all that they need and want, but if they come out into the community and the community is not receptive to receiving them, you know, kind of, then what do? They're kind of sitting still and they don't have options.
Well, exactly, and even more than that, there's so much, just even to your concerns about mental health. I mean, think about your... in a position, you're being released, you're ready to move forward with your life, and you cannot find, or it's very limited, support for you to have a life. Mm-hmm. You know, if you there's discrimination regarding your job, you cannot get housing, you're discriminated in that way. If you have a record, you can't get food aid. I mean, there's so many different ways that mass incarceration has affected first the man, the black man, you know, in terms of his ability to really even be a leader,
mm.
or co-leader, you know, in our communities. I mean, I have seen, and the data really is in about how this is eroding, you know, his self-worth and just diminishing his value in society. So you have that challenge, then you have the challenge of really his child. Mm-hmm. So you have 2.7 million children in this country have at least one parent incarcerated in the nation.
Wow.
Wow, it's right. These children, it's reported, from the Children's Defense Fund, talks about how a black boy born in 2001 has at least one in three chances of going to prison in his lifetime. So what's happening now is you're having a cycle of incarceration and a mentality that says incarceration is a standard of life.
Mm.
So if you have that mindset, then your behaviors will be in line with the lack, the disparity, the low self-esteem, low worth, that has really eroded the family structure. And then thirdly, which is the wife, the woman, the girlfriend, we say the baby mama, whatever people want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But bottom line is the black woman, who the issue I see with for her is that if her man is locked up, she's responsible for caring for, you know, either their children, trying to help him, which is a whole system that's caught up to financially just destroy her in trying to support him. And then if he's released, she's still responsible for their household because he can't get a job, he can't get housing, he cannot get food. And then you think about the psychological impact that is on the man, because he can't be the man that he wants to be,
right,
with the woman that she wants him to be. And which goes back to, do we have a society that really understands the challenges that this family is dealing with in isolation? And so therein lies our work of mission mobilization, really is to help our community to see our families. These are our families. These are our men, our women, our children.
Mm-hmm.
Should not be in this pain, this mental and psychological, physical
right.
pain
right.
by themselves.
Sheila, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to focus more on the kinds of things that you have just said that are not available to folks coming out of prison, because I'm not sure that listeners, if they don't have a personal experience with this, I don't think they understand what you mean when you say they can't get a job, they can't get housing, they can't get food. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back and we'll pick it up there. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk and a conversation with Sheila Ford Murphy, who is the CEO of Mission to Mobilization. We'll be back in a moment. Sheila Ford Murphy, CEO of Mission to Mobilization. Before the break, you've said on more than one occasion that individuals coming out of jail can't get food. job, housing. That's the basic minimum that anybody needs to live. What do you mean when you say they can't get food and jobs and housing?
Okay. So the law regarding jobs, we'll start there. So there's a law, the Ban the Box, which speaks to where employers do not will not allow or have an ex-offender disclose on their application that they have been incarcerated.
Okay.
So there are a number of states. Minnesota was the first actually to ban their box, and so little by little, we are having this law is being changed, but still 96% of organizations and businesses are able to ask that question. So if you ask that question and you have a plethora of individuals that are looking for jobs, if an employer HR person can discriminate, whether they tell you or not that they're not doing it, they can discriminate. If they see someone has a criminal background, they disclose it on the application because that's by law they can do that, then they most likely will not hire, which has been the case
okay.
in what we're finding for returning citizens. And with housing applications, the same thing, where the individual, the ex-offender, returning citizen, has to disclose if they have been incarcerated, and if so, and some of the applications could be that they cannot have a lease at all if they've ever been incarcerated. So that means they cannot have a lease, their own lease. They're probably have to try to get on a lease with somebody else, their girlfriend or their friends or their grandmother or somebody. And so that's the case where they have lost their right to have housing. And then with food, in some cases, some states where if you have been incarcerated, you cannot receive government aid for food. And so, yes, these are the basics in life, and they have been taken, or at least in part, they have been diminished and diminishing the way of life for a returning citizen.
So a returning citizen, in fact, doesn't have a lot to return to. If they can't get a job, they can't get housing, they can't get food. I mean, it certainly has more than a negative impact on their self-esteem, their mental health in general, their relationships, the whole nine yards.
Exactly. And it really is, in my opinion, is the plan to return them back to jail or prison. If you can't get a job and you're unable to receive housing or food, what are you going to do?
Right.
I mean, you're going to find a way. You're going to eat. Okay, and so then you return back to criminal activity because you do, and you have invisible bars of people in your community that don't understand that you're suffering in isolation. You may end up going back to crime and finding, as they say, three hots in a cot. So now at least you know that you have a bed to sleep on and you're going to get three meals a day. Okay, that is not, so I believe that is, that's a design, and the design is effective because it runs the billion-dollar industry, the prison industry that we now have in this country. And so I'm not a conspiracy theorist, yet the data is in on how this system works and how it has worked against African-American men in particular in this country.
And you're saying that the prison complex is a billion, as in B, billion
yes.
dollar industry.
Yes.
So the concept of corrections is just not even in there in terms of day-to-day operations.
Right.
So the communities in which returning citizens will seek to go, how does Mission to Mobilization work with communities who have been taught that you know, clearly that if you have gone to prison, that basically you're good for being thrown away, period, end of story. How do you change the community's view?
Sure, yeah. First and foremost, it's big, it's work, and it's work that's needed. You know, I believe truly only with God's help we are offering the process of healing. And so healing, meaning, you know, if you look at the kind of the definition of what we have been told about ourselves, what these returning citizens, ex-offenders, have been lied to, and how they've been abused and myths have been established about them, that we need to renew the mind of our community, because we as a community, I'm a part of it, you're a part of it, we have started to believe the things that have been said about us, right, about ex-offenders. So that's why when we hear someone, you know, oh, they have a record, or, you know, they serve time, you may not say anything, and you may try not to have a certain look on your face, but you're thinking something, and you're thinking something because you have been conditioned through so many mediums to think a certain way. Or you have been isolated to not hear anything, because when we put someone in jail or prison, a lot of people hope that you lock the door, throw away the key, and I don't want to have to think and see to think anything about that.
Mm-hmm. Ever.
So I'm ignorant to what's going on. So our role really is about renewing the mind and changing the perception, changing the way we see returning citizens. You know, I designed the I Am Human campaign, really helping people to recognize that inmates are human. The experience, the MTM experience, is a workshop. It is a simulation that allows a community group, a church, John Doe that's a neighbor, to actually take on the profile of a returning citizen and to see what it feels like to try to go for housing, work, to have vigilant neighbors that say, I don't care what happens to you, I just don't want you in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Well, I have to live somewhere. So our work really is about healing, and ultimately it really is about love, you know, loving ourselves, because my brother, my sister, is a part of me, you know. Go ahead.
It sounds like you're also working to expand the consciousness of just people in general about this issue.
Definitely. Yeah, because there has to be, I believe that there has to be a perception change in the way we think. The 4.5 million returning citizens, so this is outside of the 2.2 million that are currently incarcerated. So the 4.5 million that are now out in our communities facing the challenges that I've outlined, they are full of skills and competencies that really can bear support within our businesses. Mm-hmm. You know, when we need skilled workers, people that are committed to, to helping to build organization and build community, and we're overlooking this this labor force. And so that's a whole nother layer of work that we're also doing, and being able to highlight there are a number of, there are hundreds of what we call ex-offender friendly businesses that, you know, we partner with to be able to highlight the work that they're doing in supporting the work that we're doing.
You know, I would think that the workshops that you're doing and the role playing that you're doing with community members would be exceptionally powerful for the person who now sort of puts themselves in the shoes of that other person who they never really thought about, unfortunately, in a lot of ways.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, experiential learning to me,
is
always the best. I mean, most of the life lessons that we learn is because we went through it, and it's, you know, it moved us in a certain way that we'll never forget. And I believe that when I designed this, it was with that in mind, with some of my own experiences, to be able to write this and say, how can we take the scenario and these negative experiences and kind of put it in a little capsule, you know, for a 2.5 hour time frame, mm-hmm. and allow someone to see what that feels like. So not only do we have the returning citizen, their experience, but we also have the support system. So we have some family members. We have, you know, a grandmother or girlfriend that has to be responsible for, you know, this man, child, or, you know, individual,
right.
that is suffering with the challenges of what we call post-release syndrome.
I want to talk about post-release syndrome when we come back from the break, which we'll get to in a few minutes. But I'm wondering if you see, in general, a difference between how community responds to women who are returning citizens versus men who are returning citizens.
Sure. Oh, you want me to answer now?
Yeah.
The data shows that women that are incarcerated that the rates are increasing. So the focus really has been on men that are incarcerated. And I think that this is just my opinion, just because there has been more focus on men, that they're, you know, that we're just not conscious about what's going on with women. And so I think it's just a matter of education, that we are just not aware that it is impacting both men and women. But there are more men that are incarcerated than there are women.
Sure. Would you say that the impact is essentially the same for men as well as women who are returning?
Mm-hmm. I would say that that's hard. Because primarily women care for children, so it's a greater impact on the family.
I see.
When a woman is incarcerated,
okay,
you know, and so so I'd answer that way.
Okay, all right. We are going to take a break, but when we come back, you did mention what you refer to as PRS. Post-release syndrome. When we return, I would like to start there and have you explain to us exactly what you mean by that and what post-release syndrome is. What does it look like in these individuals? Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We will be back in just a moment with Sheila Ford Murphy, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Mission to Mobilization out of Minnesota. We'll be right back. We all experience different kinds of transitions in our life. Let's go back to this conversation about another transition. Sheila Ford Murphy, talk to us about post-release syndrome. What is that?
Okay, so a syndrome, it's a combination of several symptoms, you know, in a disease or problem.
Right.
So we have a combination of mental, physical, emotional issues that have come from lack of housing, the ability to vote, you know, issues with the family structure, inability to find housing or basic need of food. So you have a this combination, a blend, a very unhealthy blend of issues that are impacting the life of 4.5 million returning citizens. Mm-hmm. And so our work really is Mission to Mobilization's focus, and in this call right now is to help our community to see that this syndrome, this it's greater than pain. I mean, it is the hurt that we are feeling in the body of our community cannot be bared alone. And that syndrome, that issue of diseases, it really is just like, you know, if a body has a disease,
right,
the rest of the body attends to it.
Mm-hmm.
You focus on it, and you look at, okay, what do we need to do? You hurt, your leg is hurt, everything, the hand goes over to try to touch it, the eyeball is down looking at it to see what do we need to do,
right,
to heal, to bring healing.
Exactly. The notion of the I Am Human campaign that you've come up with, the Orange Jumpsuit Journey, I Am Human, what does that mean? What were you trying to accomplish with that?
Right. Really, that came out of, it kind of prompted from, I saw the movie Fruitvale Station. I had been really prayerful. And then I was reading some scripture in the book of Isaiah about the prophet, you know, walking around for 3 years, practically naked, but basically showing the shame of the nation at that time. And really felt that I was being called to, for a 30-day period, to walk around the city in an orange jumpsuit to advocate on behalf of returning citizens and inmates. I believed that people, one, you do not see an orange jumpsuit outside because, to my point earlier, it's hidden. It
right.
is behind the scenes. And so during those 30 days, I engaged people, or people engaged me, or I took notes on how I was responded to, and with the focus of advocating, really, and to bring awareness to the challenges that we're facing with inmates and with ex-offenders.
And how were you responded to?
There was a range. You know, from something as simple as, you know, fist up, go, my brother, my sister, you know, I feel you. You know, I was in a laundromat one time, and the guy said, you know, you just getting out, can I help you, to people getting across the street, walking across the street because they didn't want to engage me. I was apprehended by the police, but I did have my ID on me, and so they ran, you know, my numbers and to see if it was okay or to determine what was going on with me. But it was, and then I was within the church, there was challenges. I think the church didn't know what to do. You know, maybe they thought maybe I had the mental health issue, and even if I did, then the case should be, well, let's try to figure out how
right.
we can assist this
right.
person. So there was a range of things that I experienced or how I was responded to. But overall, I believe that the greatest growth probably was for me. You know, I mean, just from my background, I had no idea that the look, it was more than a look. I almost can't put words around the negative feeling, but I am reminded of a number of the guys that would say, you know, Ms. Sheila, the word prison is written across our forehead. And that's what I felt when I was out there in the orange jumpsuit. So I wasn't doing it for publicity. A lot of people thought that that's what it was, but it really was a consciousness, and I believe through prayer that I was led to do that. And it changed my life, and it changed our work.
And do you think that you will do something like this on a regular basis?
I don't plan to, but I feel like what I'm taking the kind of the experience to another level in terms of we have, you know, clips that look at the I am human perspective. And okay. So being able to change people's perception, so anyone that has been incarcerated in the past and now they have moved forward, they are contributing to our society, being able to show those, you know, in these small sound bites so that people can begin to really see that these individuals are human. There are brothers, fathers, sisters, friends that that we can embrace and support in whatever way that we have the ability to do so.
Is Mission to Mobilization in Minnesota only, or have you expanded outside of Minnesota, or will you expand?
It is in Minnesota, and also I have a presence here in the DMV, so in the District of Columbia, Virginia, and Maryland. I 2 years ago relocated to the Washington, D.C. area and have staff here in this region as well, and so we are expanding and are doing work in both cities. States, and one district is not considered a state, so that's
a whole other conversation.
Right, that's a whole other show.
we won't do that one. You know, when you talk about just millions upon millions of people who, for whatever reason, wind up being imprisoned, and we all know that there are lots of people in prison who are there longer than they need to be or are there in erroneously, period, shouldn't even be there. When you talk about all of these people and, you know, this notion, I'm going to throw in that word corrections, which seems to have no place in the reality of what happens.
Sure.
And you supposedly they're going into prison, they're going to have a corrective experience, which it isn't, and then they come out and they're supposed to now lead fruitful, law-abiding lives, which they can't, because they can't eat, they can't sleep, they can't work. I mean, there's just nothing that they can latch on to. There's not a lot of people, not enough people doing the kind of work that you do, so they don't particularly have a sense of being heard, understood, or valued in any way. What do we need to do?
Well, first, I believe that those that do believe to pray, that is the first thing, because to change the heart of a man, that can only be done through spiritual intervention.
Okay.
I can talk all day long, you know, and I can educate, but I believe a heart change and a mind change comes through the power of God.
Okay.
I believe that those that are believers, you know, there's a psalm that comes to my mind. It's Psalm 79, and it says, "Let the groaning of the prisoner come before you according to the greatness of your power, those appointed to die." Believing that these inmates have been appointed to die, even those that have been released, that is the mentality, and that our hearts should be to desire to make a difference. That, you know, that because we're human, they're human. You know, Dr. King says the most persistent, urgent question is, "What are you doing for others?" So this is not about me. And I believe that unchecked, you know, injustice, it's eroding our society and eventually is eroding my life. So if you're not doing it for someone else, get to the outcome, which eventually is going to erode yours in some kind of way. My hope is that I can engage people, you know, by the I Am Human clips, by, you know, hosting simulations and training that we have that's available, you know, engaging business leaders to increase, you know, kind of their bottom line when they, you know, hire these attorney citizens. But above all, you know, if we change mentality, if we change perception, we really will change the nation in ways that we would never thought we could.
And certainly it's a nation that is clear to us is in great need of change. Talk to us for a moment about the international service that you've been engaged in. You've been in India, Kenya, Uganda. What's been going on?
Yeah, so I think the most important work has been just my planning and mission work. So within Ethiopia, I have been able to use my very first writing, which was Kingdom Compass, that tool to help train the leadership development training for indigenous leaders. And so we started off with about a handful, five or so male and female leaders that wanted to go into other, you know, uncharted waters. And we had the book and material was converted, the language was converted, and have been able to now have over 125 leaders and indigenous trainers to actually go in and retrain people to talk about how they can improve their community, how they can, you know, take a small farm and expand the environment. And so that work is very inspiring, and it really kind of speaks to the fact that you can do just about anything, you know, if you by faith believe that that your work matters and that through love you can impact you know, others.
Now, you've said the Kingdom Compass, and I believe there's a Country Compass. These are two books that you have written?
Exactly, right. The Kingdom Compass really started off, I wasn't trying to write a book, and I was working with a radio station in Minnesota at the time, and I started off with just a number of clips around workplace expectations. And mm-hmm. So how could you bring your faith to work in, you know, into your work environment. And that developed into material around looking at life skills, you know, how do you move your mission forward, you know, what does it look like to be a transformational leader, you know, how can you raise dollars around a very small or large, you know, project. And so that was the Kingdom Compass, but it's spiritual undertone, and I'm not sure they say undertone, that has scripture that was throughout that material. And then the Country Compass was more on the corporate side. There were people that, you know, didn't have a faith experience, and so it was used as a kind of a driving theme to think about how do you move your mission forward, and in terms of projects that either could impact your neighborhood or your nation.
Gotcha. Sheila Fort Murphy, you have such a wealth of information sort of rolling around in your brain, it sounds like, in so many experiences. Is there a website or a way for people to be in touch to learn more about you and what you're doing?
Oh, I'd love to. People could engage us either at missiontomobilization.com, or they can call us at 888-683-5388, where some of our staff would be more than happy to connect with them and look at opportunities to talk more.
All right. Would you share that phone number again?
Sure. 888-683-5388.
Sheila Fort Murphy, CEO of Mission to Mobilization. I feel like we've just sort of tapped the beginning of all the information and the resources that you bring to bear. We might have to call you back. But I do thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Thank you.
Well, I thank you so much. Great pleasure having you.
And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. You can also listen to Mind Talk on demand at myndtalk.org. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Assistant to the executive producer is Lede Battle. The production team consists of Antonio Slade, Ariel Medley, and Janice White. Mind Talk is produced daily as an educational public service and is not intended to to replace treatment with a licensed practitioner of your choice. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And for more information, again, about Mind Talk, always go to mindtalk.org. And always remember, too, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.